All I can do right now is put on a brave face and go out there and be their leader.
The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
I want to wish a very best to Governor Jay Inslee. The breaking news that he has tested positive for COVID, and I mean that sincerely. I do not hate those with whom I disagree ideologically. I disagree with them. I don't hate them because of it. And I hope Jay Inslee, he says it's mild symptoms, and I wish him the very best. With that news that comes down today, I'm getting a lot of texts about Inslee. I don't want to joke about somebody getting COVID. No interest in that. It's interesting, you know, especially after that Nick Hanauer thing, praying for terminal cancer. I would like to hear Jay Inslee and Dow Constein, who are major recipients of Nick Hanauer money. I would like to hear them denounce him. Or their silence is complicity. We'll find out about that. Okay. Without his mere prelude, let's get to The Big Lead.
The Big Lead, Dory Monson Show exclusive.
Well, the details unfolded as we were on the air yesterday. You no doubt have heard the updates earlier today, and it is just god-awful. 19 fourth graders and their teachers killed by a loner gunman who had apparently displayed lots of mental illness, and it was deepening. He bought these guns legally on his 18th birthday. What does this mean for our state, our schools, our kids, our families? The superintendent of public instruction here in the state of Washington is Chris Rakedahl. He joins us this afternoon here on the Dory Monson Show. Chris, I always appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, Dory. Tough day for the country.
Well, it is. It's just, it's unimaginable when we have monsters who walk in our midst. Let's talk about our schools. We've had mass shootings in our schools in the state. What do you want kids and parents to know in the wake of what happened yesterday in Texas?
Well, there's probably a couple of key things. First and foremost is, you know, take the moment to mourn. We all need to grapple with this emotionally, and so we need to give students and family space to do that. Two, we have some of the best safety protocols in the country. We are a state that, like many, has regular drills and trainings. We have annual safety reviews that our districts do. We're one of the states that does have threat assessment as a regular practice. What that means is when we think there is a student, like one of these gunmen, who is capable of this and that individual is identified, we have regional teams that can meet with that student and family. Mental health counselors are there, school personnel, as well as law enforcement if necessary. So there's always more you can do, but the state is one of the better in terms of the framework that we produce.
Let me jump in on the threat assessment, because I do think that's critical. So what are the limits of what you can do? What if the kid, the family, aren't receptive to that? Because I know, and you know, Chris, that most teachers in the schools, most kids in the schools, they know which kids to be afraid of. And, you know, sometimes they, you know, used to joke about it in the yearbook with things you never should say about another kid. But you know what I'm talking about. Everybody knows the kids who should be looked at. So how do you follow through on that threat assessment?
Well, it isn't casual. You know, it isn't two kids are having a disagreement, so somebody accuses the other, and, you know, there's a process. There's generally evidence of that. So the students have come forward and they've said, hey, we've seen online imagery or online threats, or something's happened in the school, or maybe a counselor's identified it through a one-on-one. There's generally a level of evidence here that warrants that kind of deep and intensive focus. And so our schools know those protocols. They generally call a regional coordinator in the area. We don't have personnel to do this in every building, but there's an expert in every region who gets that call. Then they pull the team together. And, you know, we meet with students about this, and we meet with families. And it's not particularly controversial, because at the time we're usually intervening well before there's any actual violence.
Right. Yeah. No, I like that a lot. One thing that I can't stand about the last day with media and politicians. I'm not accused of being the calm-headed one very often, Chris, but here's what I do know. I know that our public schools are statistically, even after yesterday, the safest place a kid can be. They're safer than the playgrounds or the sports fields. They're safer than driving to school, driving home from school. They're safer than being at home. More kids die in all of those other places than they do in public schools in America every year. I get really angry, Chris, at how the media and politicians ramp up the hysteria, frighten kids even more than they already are, and don't stress that this is still incredibly rare, and you don't have to go to school being afraid that you're going to be gunned down. And I really don't understand why we don't have more media people, more politicians, more everybody giving that message to our kids instead of trying to scare them even more today.
Yeah, it is a gut-wrenching thing, and obviously with our ubiquitous social media, we see every crisis in every school everywhere in the world instantaneously, so there is this sense that gets created that it's real everywhere, and I want to double down on what you just said. Statistically speaking, school shootings are still exceedingly rare, and when you think about the amount of contact hours we have with children, 1 million kids, 1,000 hours a year in our schools. You know, Washington State has 1 billion contact hours with kids, and knock on wood and pray to God, we've lost one life in 5 years to a shooting. Unfortunately, we've lost 400 school-aged children to suicide, half of which are by gun in their own homes. So to your point, it is exceedingly rare. It doesn't mean it isn't gut-wrenching when you see this
of
in
course,
Texas or
of
Buffalo.
Of course it is, yeah.
But it is much more likely that really sound practices in securing our firearms, or quite frankly, as I've been saying, if you don't absolutely need one, please reconsider. That will save far, far more lives immediately if people will rethink that.
Okay, and I think that is why the hysteria is ramped up, because you and I agree on the statistics, and kids are already anxious enough, especially after the last 2 years, and I think that everybody telling children that they're going to be gunned down, and, you know, with all due respect, even the statement you released yesterday, Chris, I take a lot of issues with that, because, you know, when you talked about there is simply no debate, our homes are safer when there are no guns. There are a lot of us. I didn't become a gun owner until my kids were grown. I frankly didn't want them and their friends in the house with a gun. But I'm an incredibly safe gun owner, storage and all of that. When you say there's simply no debate, now we're using yesterday to assert a truth that is not true. It is not true in my home, Chris. And I don't know why we're using yesterday to assert that.
It is absolutely true that gun density creates more violence in communities. That is a fact. It's every bit of research. Even the NRA agrees that communities with higher volumes of guns end up with more murders, homicides, accidental shootings, and suicide. That's a fact. It's generally unsecured firearms. And the point I'm trying to make is the point you just made moments ago. Everyone else is going to have raging political debates about more gun control and more measures, and they should have those. What I can do as an educator is say to families, reconsider your choices. If you are a gun owner and it's important to you and you can keep it safe, like, of course you have a right to do that. If you're somebody who randomly went out, thought you needed a firearm, and you are prepared to kill a person coming into your home, the data is clear. You are much more likely to lose your own life or have somebody in your family lose their life with that firearm than you will ever do in protecting yourself. And so I'm just adding to the discussion, consider the choices you make, because we can't control the U.S. Senate. We can't control whether 30-clip or 30-round magazines are going to be, you know, outlawed in the future. What we can do is own our own decisions to create a safer environment, and fewer guns equals fewer lost lives.
And in our state, Democrats have been in charge of the governor's mansion, the Senate, the House for 5 years. They've had citizens' initiatives that were more restrictive for gun ownership. I mean, if it hasn't gotten done by now. The problem, of course, is there is a constitutional element that has to be followed. I am all for things that are going to make us safer as a society, but it must be constitutional. Is that something else we agree on?
Oh, totally, totally. And I'm not even talking about the legal side. I'm just saying within your constitutional rights, what personal choices could you make to keep your family safer? And one of them is think about that deadly firearm in your home and whether you truly need it or not. Just make that personal choice and reevaluate that.
Okay, yeah. I think that's fair and reasonable. The concern that I have, Chris, is when the politicians start talking about new laws, they don't really impact criminals. Criminals don't tend to follow laws. And look, if I could blink my eyes and make 300 million guns in America disappear, this is an entirely different conversation. But you and I can't do that. And the laws tend to only impact law-abiding people, which means we're outgunned by the criminals. And that's why I think that we need to have some balance in this debate here that often is lacking when I hear people proselytizing after tragedies.
Yeah, and again, I don't have all the information to have the good gun debate versus the bad gun debate. Sure. What I can tell you is the data. And yesterday's a powerful example. This is a young man who waited till he could legally buy firearms at the age of 18. And so I'm coming at you as an educator again. If it was a 21-year-old age limit to buy that kind of weapon, would it have happened? I don't know. But what I know from brain development, particularly in young men, is they're not actually done forming parts of their cortex until their early 20s.
No, we're not.
Even gun ownership later in life creates more safety than allowing an 18-year-old or a 16-year-old or a 14-year-old to access a firearm. So yeah. I do think there's more we can do legally. I do.
Let's get back to what we agree on. Schools are still incredibly safe. Kids are already very anxious after the last 2 years, are suffering from all kinds of mental anxiety issues. And I think the last thing that we need on a day like today is to have politicians and media deepening the anxiety in kids, because it is the mental illness component also that we need to focus on. And I'm just trying to be a voice in the wilderness here, Chris, and say that the schools are not dangerous despite unspeakable tragedies like yesterday. And I would hope that more in my industry would make sure that message is out there to our kids.
A very important message. We have to lead with letting them have this moment to mourn, recognize they're seeing this all over the country, recognize that it's still exceedingly rare. Our schools are very, very safe, and acknowledge that this risk still exists. This could happen tomorrow or today in one of our schools, especially somebody with 30-round magazines, body armor, all the rest. We know this is still a risk, so you can't ever totally eliminate it, but I share your passion for trying to put this in context for folks and then have the healthier debate about what's next. You know me, I've spoken to you a lot of times. I want to be serious about this issue, and we are, and I want a lot more conversation around the 80 kids a year who are school age, who die by suicide, half of which are by gun, most of which is because those firearms aren't secured in the home.
All right. Chris, I appreciate you coming on with me today. Thank you for your time.
Take care.
Chris Reichdahler, Superintendent of Public Instruction here in Washington. And there are a lot of other areas I would have loved to have gone, but we were limited in the amount of time that he had. I'm getting a bunch of texts, a bunch of people saying, Dory, why aren't you talking about the transgender angle to this story yesterday? Because I don't know if there is one. I heard that the shooter was wearing mascara and that he was often seen wearing mascara. That does not necessarily make one transgender. I just don't know anything other than that. But there are some people who are suggesting that the stuff that he might have been delving into in the internet pushed him down some pathways like that. I don't know if there's any connection. And I just because I have criticisms with that agenda in our schools, I have no idea if it's connected to this in any meaningful way, and that's something I just choose not to speculate on. Now, just responding to something that Chris Reichdahl was talking about. He talked about raising the age for buying guns to 21 because the cerebral cortex is not developed. This is from, and Look, I appreciate that Rachel comes out. He knows that I'm a staunch critic of a lot of stuff that's happening in our schools right now. But he and I still come on and have conversations. But the same party that wants to raise the age for guns, as I said last hour, they want to lower the voting age to 16. Not only that, I do wish I had brought this up to Chris Rachel. Our schools actively pull 13-year-olds away from their parents, build a wall between kids and their parents, and send them to doctors who then encourage them through a very active agenda that's going on to take powerful, forever body-changing hormones. And sometimes to provide surgery for the children without the parents knowing that. So how in the heck can the radical left say, well, let's raise the age for buying guns? Kids can't make that decision about buying a gun. But they say, oh, and 13-year-olds should be able to cut off their breasts and their penis. And we should cut the parents out of it because we know better than the mom and dad. So is their brain developed or not? And if it's not, then let's be consistent. And let's say that maybe you need to be 18 before you make decisions about changing your gender forever. Maybe you have to be 21 to vote and to buy a gun. But it's all politics. It's all, let's exploit this. Checking, still no condemnation from Jay Inslee, who has time. He's working from home. Doesn't have to commute. Jay Inslee, nor Dow Constitution. Neither one has still condemned their longtime political ally, Nick Hanauer, praying for terminal cancer and agonizing deaths for Republicans today. I would want to distance myself from him as quickly as possible if I were Dow Constantine and Jay Inslee. But he's their buddy. He's their ideological partner. So they can't condemn him. They can... I can't say Constantine and Inslee. Pray for the deaths of their political opponents. But Nick Hanauer, he clearly does. That's going to be interesting when he tries to lead another let's raise everybody's taxes initiative. And then one other thing, real quick. Bruce Harrell, he's released a statement complaining that cities can't do their own gun laws because of preemption. Preemption's part of our state constitution. All these guys want to do stuff that has nothing to do with the Constitution or is extra constitutional. It's crazy. Okay, we're going to check the news for you, and then lots more to come here on the Dory Monson Show. Last weekend, another shocking crime in Ballard. It happened at a Little League field. A Little League field that I played on many, many times when I was in Ballard Little League. But the sort of thing didn't happen when I was playing Little League in Ballard. A guy with multiple priors jumped in a car with a child inside, stole the car, thereby kidnapping the child. A bunch of bystanders jumped into action and helped corral the guy. We know his name, and we know a little bit about his criminal history. It's Ryan Lee Popplewell. And Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office joins us here on the Dory Monson Show. Hey, Casey, always great to talk with you.
You too, Dory.
So do we know the crime itself, where he stole the car with the child inside? Were the keys in the car? Do you have any idea about that?
I don't know that specifically, but I know that the car was available. It was, you know, the dad just ran back for a second, you know,
yeah,
which you should be able to do, you know. And I know my parents did it and a few times. I think most parents do it every once in a while, but you never think that this kind of, you know, really traumatic event is going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, they caught the guy, the kid's okay. But You have, in the prosecutor's office, filing the charges against him. You took a look at Papa Wells' criminal history. Let's start back in September of last year. He had been arrested for two burglaries in West Seattle. Your office asked for what kind of bail?
We asked in these West Seattle cases for him to be held on $50,000 bail. We made the argument that he's a danger to the community and that if he was released, he's unlikely to return.
And the judge in that case, Kuljinder Dhillon, set bail at what?
It was $5,000 that was set at the first appearance. And those, you know, judges have hard decisions. They listen to both the prosecutors and the defense attorneys, and then they make a ruling based off of that. We thought that we had enough of a reason for that bail. But, you know, we don't always win those arguments.
Okay. When she reduces it from $50,000 to $5,000, that means the suspect can get bonded out for $500, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And in this case, he was bailed out by the Northwest Community Bail Fund, which is kind of the shadowy group. They will never do interviews, but they get funding to just bail out suspects in court, right?
That's what happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
We see that in a pretty fair number of cases, in a good number of cases. And that's, you know, that's concerning for us. But, you know, that's what we can do is keep making those arguments where we think it's warranted to keep people behind bars.
Well, and then just 2 months later, December of last year, he was arrested for an attempted motor vehicle theft in the Queen Anne neighborhood. And this time, what kind of bail did your office seek?
Well, because it was a stolen vehicle case, there wasn't a person involved in there. We thought that we could get $10,000 bail. So we made that argument. We didn't get that. The first appearance judge said, you know, understandably, they've got hard decisions here from both sides. The first appearance judge there set bail at $5,000.
Well, but one of the reasons for bail is to try to ensure that somebody shows up in court, right? Or if they can't make bail, that they're in custody until their next court appearance. And that is one of the primary reasons for bail, correct?
It absolutely is. And there's three ways that we can argue for bail. And throughout the state, there's a presumption of release written into the court rules. And judges have to take into consideration what someone is able to reasonably pay. So we've got to make an argument that either someone will interfere with the administration of justice, you know, try to get out and tamper with witnesses, or if they're unlikely to return to court. And we see people with, you know, so many warrants, that's a pretty safe argument that we made here.
Right.
Or is somebody a danger to the community, which is a very common argument that we make for someone to be held on bail.
And is this Popplewell, is he a homeless guy, do we know?
I'm not sure. I saw in a document that he went into a tent, but it also lists a previous address. So
okay.
I'm not sure on that one. We should find out more on Wednesday.
Got it. Okay, so once again, the Northwest Community Bail Fund again bails this guy out, and he was free on the streets. And that brings us to what happened last week. Well, there are a couple things. With all his multiple felonies, he had an ankle bracelet. He tampered with it or cut it off. And then
right.
that takes us up to this kidnapping last weekend, right?
Well, there was also a case. There was a third felony case that we filed in January. His defense attorney made a motion to have him released. And on the terms of go to treatment, and then when you're done with treatment, come back to the jail within 2 hours. And, you know, we understand and in a lot of cases think that treatment works when there's a likelihood that it will be successful or even a relative likelihood that it'll be successful. But we didn't think, based off of his, you know, more than a dozen previous warrants, that he would follow those court orders. And we didn't think that was the best route, even though, you know, he may need treatment, but I'm not sure, or we didn't think that this exact route would be the best way to do it, because we didn't think that he would comply with the court terms. Unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. Our high priority repeat offender group found out that he had tampered with his electronic home monitoring device, which the prosecutor's office had objected to, on a weekend. Immediately that weekend, tried to get a hearing, was able to get a hearing on May 19th, where we asked a warrant. That warrant was issued, and that warrant was active when he was picked up in this kidnapping case on Saturday.
Finally, he's being held. You asked for $250,000 bail, and the judge granted that?
Yes. Judge Hirakawa agreed with us on that one and issued that full $250,000.
So he's still locked up?
He is, yes. And okay. He's expected to remain there. So that's reassuring, you know, in terms of public safety there.
I know. It's just, what if that kid had been killed?
It's terrifying.
And I know we can't, you know, always do law and justice by hypotheticals, but when you have a guy with multiple felonies, including a bunch in Pierce County that we haven't even discussed, but you have a guy that we have this group that keeps bailing him out. We have judges who keep reducing the bail. And what if that kid had been killed over the weekend? It's just.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that poor parent. Who in that moment, can you imagine that? Seeing your car drive away and knowing that your son is in there? I mean, that's a traumatic event that kid and that parent and that family will never forget. The trauma of that's awful.
Yeah, it is. All right, well, I'm glad you guys finally got him locked up at least for a while here, and we'll keep an eye on the case. Casey, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate you coming on with me today.
You bet. You too, Dor. Have a good one.
All right. Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. I really like Casey. He's a good guy. And that's the craziness, though. You know, especially on a day like today where we have all these politicians who are saying that we need tougher gun laws. And the reality that we have judges and these groups, these far left groups that reduce bail and then bail out dangerous repeat felons. We've got a mania to get as many criminals on the street to create as much chaos as possible. And those same people who say, oh, but if you listen to us on guns, we'll make society safer. Breaking news. We told you earlier that Jay Inslee has tested positive for COVID. He says he has mild symptoms and is working from home. Just getting word right now that Lieutenant Governor Denny Heck also has tested positive for COVID. So what happens if both of them get too sick to work, you're wondering? Well, a crazy element in our Constitution, even though radio hadn't been invented yet, but in our state Constitution, they said if any state resident has the highest rated local news talk show in the United States of America, they are third in line for the governorship, to be gubernatorial. So I'm hoping that Jay Inslee and Denny Heck don't get sick. But if they do, I'll finally fix this state. Do we have to go back to the shower curtains? Is that what this is going to take? We have to get all the shower curtains back and start, you know, Man, I hate the shower curtains. All right, quick time. I actually have some audio from Jay Inslee talking about how effective the vaccines are. And yet he's got COVID. I'm starting to wonder about these vaccines. I'll play you that audio. It's coming up. Lots more to come here on the Dory Monson Show. Stretch we come. What a day, what a show, what a show, what a day. We usually do awesome audio here, but nothing in the audio is very funny today. And we didn't wanna pretend like it was, so we're just gonna continue with the news here. If you were not listening a couple of hours ago, I talked with independent journalist Ali Bradley, who has been covering the U.S.-Mexico border, but she went up to Uvalde, Texas, when all this happened, and she was in Uvalde as we talked to her earlier this afternoon.
Today, you can just, the tragedy and the grief that these people are feeling is palpable. I mean, this is a small enough community that everybody knows everybody. There's only, a couple of elementary schools, so all of these kids and parents, they all are around each other all the time. And so you can just see it on these families' faces that are, you know, that live in this area that are walking up to still see a very active scene as Texas DPS and Border Patrol and the other agencies are out here looking for clues, looking for, you know, things that they can use to piece together what really happened and why it happened. At this point, they still don't really have a clear motive.
Okay. Now, there is one question that I think is incredibly important that I've heard very little media focus on. I want to know how this 18-year-old, he was bullied. We are told he was bullied because his family was so poor and he wore clothes that were rather ragged, and he was bullied for being poor. I'd heard that he worked at a Wendy's, but Allie heard that he was unemployed. How is a kid? He left his mom's house because she cut off the Wi-Fi, and he moved in with his grandparents because being online was more important than having a relationship with a parent in today's sick society. But how did this guy get $5,000 to buy these guns on his 18th birthday? I'm getting some listeners in the text message asking the same thing. Who gave him the money? Or how did he get the money? Because he bought, I think it was $4,800 that he spent on the guns that he purchased a week or two ago on his 18th birthday. Where in the world did somebody who'd been bullied for being so poor, who either worked a little tiny bit at Wendy's or was unemployed, where in the world did he get the money? And I asked Allie Bradley if she had heard.
You know, I don't know. And I mean, Lieutenant Olivares today said he was unemployed. So, you know, I don't know where he would have procured those funds to be able to go out and buy guns. You know, a lot of people are saying, and there's multiple sources reporting that, you know, he went out and got that gun legally after he turned 18, shortly after he turned 18. So there's a couple of things, you know, I've learned where this potentially was, where he bought these weapons. So I'm going to do my best to dig into that and get that reported for you as well.
And we'll stay in touch with her because Allie's a great reporter. You can follow her work on Twitter at Allie Bradley TV. And Allie is A-L-I, at Allie Bradley TV. She used to be at Fox 13. And then she became like Brandy. She became an independent journalist, and she does a great job covering the insanity of what the United States is doing on the U.S.-Mexico border. The other breaking news that we've been following, Governor Jay Inslee just revealed that he has tested positive for COVID, as well as Lieutenant Governor Denny Heck just in the last half hour. He announced that he has tested positive, and I thought those vaccines were supposed to work.
The reason we're making this decision, however, though, is these vaccines are extremely effective. They're one of the most effective medicines we've ever invented. They have, you know, as much as 95% effectiveness. That is an incredible scientific achievement.
I don't think they are effective. Jay Inslee still has a vaccine mandate that got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of state workers fired. Because if they were so irresponsible to not get the vaccine, they might get COVID. And yet, the most vaccinated, boosted governor gets COVID. Remember during the campaign when Biden was running?
What can we do to fight the COVID pandemic? And the answer to that is really easy. Elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to these positions.
That didn't work either. The shots didn't work. The boosters didn't work. Electing Joe Biden, those 81 million brilliant Americans, that didn't work. I'm starting to doubt Jay Inslee's word. Okay, I got to get out of here. John Carley and Sherry Elliker show coming up next. God bless you in these crazy times. And we'll see you back here tomorrow. Hi now.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.